And I think the process of not letting our attention get trapped into only looking at problems and potential problems and suffering, the process of opening up to the fact that there also are things that are working and there are people who are supporting us in this kind of way, is one of the things that keeps us mentally healthy.
That is author and leading authority on Japanese psychology, Greg Creech, and this is episode 9 of the Ikigai Podcast. Find your Ikigai at IkigaiTribe.com. Hello, it's Nick Kemp here from IkigaiTribe.com with episode 9 of the Ikigai Podcast. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Greg Creech on the subject of using Japanese psychology in this time of uncertainty. I hope you enjoy this episode. In this episode of the Ikigai Podcast, I am speaking with Greg Creech. Now, Greg, you are the author of several books, including the award-winning book Nikan, Gratitude, Grace, and the Japanese Art of Self-Reflection, The Art of Taking Action, Lessons from Japanese Psychology, and also the book Tunneling Your Sunlight, 21 Maxims of Living Wisdom from Buddhism and Japanese Psychology to Cope with Difficult Times. And along with your wife, Linda, you are the founders of the Todo Institute, and Todo meaning Eastern Way, a nonprofit center in Vermont that uses Japanese psychology as an alternative to traditional Western approaches to psychology. And these methods you use include Nikan therapy, Morita therapy, and Kaizen. And your work supports a blend of the psychological, the spiritual, and the practical based on values such as purpose, gratitude, mindfulness, compassion, and constructive action. And over the past 30 years, you have introduced Japanese psychology to more than 10,000 people through your workshops and online courses. So thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Nick, for having me. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you.
So I feel like I actually know you, Greg, because I've just gone through your course on tricycle.org, the Japanese Art of Self-Reflection, Nikan and the Buddhist Path to Gratitude, Grace, and Faith. Now, I found that very helpful, and the course actually reminded me of a time in my life when I was getting very close to my wife. My wife is Japanese, and I was living in Japan, and I was living in Tokyo, and she was living in Nagoya, and she had just got a new job with a company, and she was required to do a Nikan retreat, and it was extremely intense. She had to live in a temple for 5 days and go through this process of self-reflection and then talk to a total stranger, the Obosan's wife, obviously about very deeply personal things over 5 days. And when she came out of it, she had this feeling of being free in two senses, just sort of being free from this intense experience, but also free from perhaps what she learned about life and her own life and her own past. So Nikan is something I'd love to touch on. But before we begin, I thought we'd start off with a quote, because we're living in this challenging time of this global pandemic. For many people, they've lost their jobs, their livelihood, and you know, they've maybe lost even loved ones. So I'll just quote from your book, The Art of Taking Action. Whenever we're facing a challenging situation, one of the wisest things we can do is take a few minutes to distinguish between what's controllable and what isn't controllable. So as a place to start,
we've lost a lot of control. What are your thoughts and advice on what we're going through, and how can we distinguish what's controllable and what isn't in this new era we're living in?
Well, it's obviously a rare situation, and as we were talking before, this is new territory for all of us. So there's no experts around, but I think we really are facing a situation, most of us who have very little control when we step back and look at that question: what's controllable and what isn't. Mm. My family is in isolation in our home. We're comfortable. We have food and electricity and internet, but we're basically not going out, as many people aren't, except to buy food or go to the post office, pick up our mail a couple of times a week. And so our control is really very limited to what we do within this house, right? And not having contact with other people, maintaining that kind of distance in order to try to flatten the curve, as they're suggesting, as far as the pandemic is concerned. But the we're looking at a virus which not only we can't control, but nobody seems to be able to control. And we're having decisions made for us by local and state governments and federal governments over which we really have no control at this point in time. So I think that we're facing a situation in which we're having to deal with circumstances, most of which are beyond our control. And I would suggest that that's actually true through most of our life, and that it just becomes more obvious in a situation like this. But I think we often wake up in the morning and we start our day with a sense of security that we know what our day is going to be like, right? We're going to make our coffee. We're going to take a shower. We're going to get in our car. We're going to go to work. We're going to have a couple of meetings and come home and have dinner and maybe exercise. And we kind of have a plan for the day and the next day and when we go on vacation. We have this sense of certainty and control when we really don't. Mm-hmm. So I think it's somewhat of an illusion. And now we're kind of facing the fact that it really is an illusion, because now it's very obvious that we can't control these things. But I don't think we've ever had much control over life beyond our own conduct, our own behavior, and how we handle things. And I think that that's really where we have to put our energy, is looking at how we're handling the situation. I was talking with a colleague of mine who's also trained in Japanese psychology, and she was suggesting this idea that if we imagine that it was 5 or 10 years down the road, and we were looking back over this period of time right now, and we were looking at our life and how we lived during this time, how we conducted ourselves, how would we want to remember that? How would we want to be able to remember how we acted during this really challenging and difficult time? And I think when I thought about that, it really immediately stimulated this idea of integrity, that I would hope that I could look back at this time and think that I had lived with integrity, whatever that means to me, right, in mm-hmm. terms of my day-to-day existence. But I think it's an interesting way to look at it, to think that the time has passed and now we're looking back, and we want to see ourselves, most of us want to see ourselves as having coped well, as having lived with some integrity, as having treated other people well, as having been compassionate and not just self-centered under challenging circumstances. So this issue of what's controllable really comes down to how are we going to handle on a day-to-day, on a moment-to-moment basis, how are we going to conduct ourselves in the context of a very challenging situation?
Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, The Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit IkigaiTribe.com. Now back to the episode.
Yes, I agree. And I think that that perspective of imagining looking back on how you behave and what actions you take, it's probably a good place to start. I've been thinking a lot recently on, in a way, this is either an opportunity or I think we're finding out very quickly what is important in our lives now that we've lost so much control. You know, we can't catch up with friends. And as you mentioned before, we started recording, for some of us, we can't even go see family. And we might not be able to say goodbye to members of our family in person. So for me, I think in terms of my fascination with Ikigai, it's made me realize that this probably is a chance to work out what is our Ikigai. And I think a lot of people are finding out, you know, family, friends are perhaps the most important things in our lives. We do have an opportunity to perhaps think, how can we handle this situation? And what really is important? And as you know, Ikigai is greatly misunderstood. And Ikigai relates to our day-to-day living. So our day-to-day living is really the only way we experience life. We have all these things we've enjoyed and probably taken for granted, and now we don't have them.
I think that because so many of us are in isolation, and at least a number of us have found that we now have extra time on our hand.
Yes,
and you know, we can control in many cases how we use that time, right? And so we can use that time kind of binge watching on Netflix. But we can also use that time doing some quiet self-reflection on exactly the kinds of questions and the issues that you're raising, which is to try to really get in touch with what is important in our lives. And I think you're right. In many cases, people do immediately start thinking of the people that they're close to, their loved ones, their family, their good friends, their teachers. Those suddenly rise in importance as we're faced with this situation, and we really can think about the relative value of different aspects of our life. So I think that that's one of the things that can come out of this. And I had a meeting, an online meeting with people who've been in a course that I just finished called The Art of Taking Action. And we were talking about the circumstances, and this one gentleman who's, you know, probably in his 60s or early 70s was saying that he has I think three daughters, and so they set up a way to kind of connect with each other online, but one of them has been estranged from him for a number of years now, and so he was connecting with his other two children, and one of his other daughters said, well, do you want me to ask so-and-so, the third daughter, if she wants to be part of this this family connection? And he said, well, you can ask her. I'm guessing that she's going to have no interest. But she did have an interest, and she actually reconnected with her family, particularly her father, which hasn't happened for years. So I'm not trying to paint a picture of the coronavirus as being a full of blessings, but in this case, one of the outcomes of the people's reflection on what's important is that we think about some of the estrangement that we may have from other people in our lives, particularly family members. And we realize that we don't want, if something happens to them or something happens to me, we don't want things to end with that kind of unfinished business, right? So in this case, the threat of this virus may actually move us in the direction of reconnecting in a more compassionate or kind way with people that we've been disconnected from.
Yeah, I agree. There is opportunity for us to really find out what we value. And as your example showed, we make decisions to finally reconnect with people. So you mentioned that it is an opportunity perhaps for us to reflect or self-reflect. So let's touch on Nikan, which is something you teach. And you describe Nikan as a kind of technology. So would you like to touch on what you mean by that and also introduce the three Nikan questions?
Sure. Nikan is really a method of self-reflection. You know, I went through the same experience that you described that your wife had.
Okay.
This would be probably 31 years ago in Japan, in fact, not far from Nagoya. In a Nikon center there, except I was foolish enough to sign up for 2 weeks rather than 5 days. So I went through that process. And for those of you who are curious, it's really a process in which you spend about 15, 16 hours a day facing a wall and just reflecting quietly on how you've lived your life, going through your life in a structured way through the years, and also through the different people who have been meaningful people in your life. And that's all you do. And then you sleep and then you wake up and do the same thing. But it was the most profound experience of my life. And it's probably the experience that kind of set me in the direction of making this work my ikigai, as you would say, Nick, mm-hmm. For the last 30 years, my purpose for the last 30 years. It's a very structured methodology. And what I mean by that is when I researched material for my book on Nikan, I tried to look at just the general theme of self-reflection. And I found that almost every spiritual and religious tradition encourages self-reflection. But I found that in many cases, there was an absence of an actual methodology of how to do this. What are the mechanics of doing this? You know, do you just go out in the woods or into a cabin in the woods or into the mountains for a week or 2 weeks and just sit there and kind of think or reflect? Nikan actually has a structure to it. And so the core structure are these three questions. And the first question is, what have I received from others? Or if you're doing Nikan on a person, if you were doing Nikan on your wife, Nick, it would be, what have I received from my wife? The second question is, what have I given? And the third question is, what troubles and difficulties have I caused others? It's a very simple framework which can be used, and I've worked with children as young as 5 years old who can easily understand those questions and actually work with that type of reflective process. But to kind of jump into the particular application to our situation right now, you know, I recently wrote a poem, and I think that there's kind of two directions we can go in that I feel are somewhat off track. And one direction is the direction of looking at our circumstances and just seeing only the problems and the suffering and the difficulties.
Yes.
And that's a very seductive path right now, because we're challenged by a lot of difficulties and problems and potential things that might come up as this unfolds. The other path that I think I see is people kind of putting a sugar coating on this, that it's creating these wonderful opportunities, mm-hmm. and you know, it's opening up a chance to remove the pollution from the atmosphere. And I'm not saying that there aren't opportunities or that the atmosphere isn't incurring less pollution, but I think that can be a more Pollyannish type of path, right, where we don't see that there are real problems that we're facing. And so I tried to use this Nikan process to think about this idea, which originally comes from a Benedictine monk by the name of David Steindl Rast, Brother David Steindl Rast, who's based, I think, in Austria. He writes a lot about gratitude. And he said something once that really stayed with me. He said that we can't be thankful for everything, but we can, in any moment, we can find something to be thankful for, right? And I think he said that in response to somebody asking him, well, can you be thankful for war? You know, can you be thankful for violence? Or today he might be asked, can you be thankful for for a pandemic.
Yes.
But that was his response. And I think it's a wonderful response because, you know, we can't be thankful for all these people getting sick and being quarantined and suffering with illness and in some cases dying. We can't be thankful for that. But we can be thankful for all of the healthcare workers, the doctors and the nurses aides and the people who are working on the front lines, right? Under very, very difficult conditions, without, in many cases, the kind of equipment they need, the kind of medical technology they need. There's no real treatment for this virus at this point. So we can be thankful that there are people out there who are making great sacrifices and taking great risks to try to ultimately protect us and take care of other people, but also protect those of us who are isolated from this disease. So that is something we can be thankful for. And I think we can, as I wrote this poem, I went through that kind of a list. You know, we can't be thankful for, in the United States, kind of the economy crashing, but we can be thankful that there is a safety net, that there's unemployment insurance, and that there's that the government is trying to provide people with financial support, that we have, many of us have connections with people in our community or church or family who wouldn't let us starve to death as a homeless person on the street. So we can be thankful for those things, even though we can't be thankful for what's happening economically around the world. And just even in my own situation, you know, I can be thankful that I live in a comfortable place. I'm surrounded by woods, so I can actually go out in the woods each day. I have internet access, which is how we're talking right now. I have electricity. I have happen to be living with two women who are great cooks, so I'm actually eating quite well. And I'm a baker, so I come from a line of bakers in our family. So I bake sourdough breads, and so I have a lot to be thankful for, even though my life has changed dramatically, and I have my own losses and things that I miss. I can actually find things to be thankful for, and I think that path is that what in Buddhism they call it the middle way, but it's the idea that we acknowledge the suffering of the situation, but we see that the situation is more than just suffering.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. That there are also things that we can appreciate and be thankful for within the context of the suffering and the challenges that are going on right now.
That poem you wrote, that's Beyond the Veil of Disappointment?
Yes, yeah, I think I said that to you.
Yeah, so I'll link to that poem in the podcast notes. But yeah, I was reading that this morning and thinking it was so true that we're going through this very unpleasant experience with all this uncertainty, but you know, we can reflect on what we do have and, you know, even what we've had in the past. And just to read a few lines of that poem, you know, we can't be thankful for the empty shelves at the supermarket, but we can be thankful for the food we are able to buy and the farmers, drivers, and employees who got it there. So that's just one thing. And I'm sure everyone listening could write an endless list on what we can't be thankful for, but what we can be thankful for related to the same thing.
And I think the process of not letting our attention get trapped into only looking at problems and potential problems and suffering, the process of opening up to the fact that there also are things that are working and there are people who are supporting us in this kind of way, is one of the things that keeps us mentally healthy in a circumstance like this, under these kinds of conditions. Because if we get caught in this spiral of negativity, right, then it's very hard for us to maintain any kind of good mental health or even sanity under the circumstances. And you know, one of the things that I'm very aware of, because as I think you're in a situation where you're living with somebody else, and I have two people from my family, my wife and my daughter, and part of because we see each other 24 hours a day,
yeah.
which is very challenging for many families. But you know, they're counting on me to be able to maintain my composure and equanimity, and also good spirits
yes.
under unchallenging circumstances. And I'm counting on them as well. You know, they're my cheerleaders, and I'm their cheerleader, right? And so it's not just for ourselves that we're trying to keep our attention balanced between things that are in the category of suffering and things that are in the category of blessings, but it's also for the people that you're living with. You know, most people know that living with somebody who is constantly negative or constantly depressed, it really takes its toll on you, right?
Yes.
So again, when we look back at this period of time, we really don't want to be that person. You
know? No.
I want to be the person, at least I'll speak for myself, that helped to lift the spirits of the people around me rather than pull them down. And I think it's a challenge, but I think seeing life in this kind of way, in this middle path kind of way, gives us a better chance of doing that for ourselves, but also for the people that we come in contact with.
You're touching on an area I wanted to ask you about, and that's our feelings. So many of us are now going through probably negative or very frustrating feelings, and you write, feelings are sensations, and the ability to tolerate sensations we'd rather not have is supremely important. Without such tolerance, our lives remain needlessly vulnerable to our wild and fickle feelings, and our plans get needlessly derailed. Now, we're dealing with an extreme situation, and we have all these feelings of frustration, uncertainty, perhaps even anger. So do you want to touch on that, Greg, how we can cope with these feelings that you describe as sensation?
I think one of the distinctive features of Japanese psychology, in this case particularly Morita therapy, is a view that really is very contrary to most Western psychology. And it's this idea that our feelings are primarily uncontrollable, right? And so so in a traditional meaning Western kind of psychotherapeutic environment, if somebody comes in and they say, the problem I'm having is my feelings, right? I feel depressed, or I feel anxious, or I feel lonely, right? And then the work that's done therapeutically is try to help that person to change their feelings, right? So they don't feel depressed and they don't feel anxious, they feel confident. And so we start with what I consider to be just a more realistic perspective, that we really can't control our feelings, that we can't control feeling anxious. And most of us are finding that out right now, is that if you become aware that you're feeling anxious, it's not like you can just hit a button and turn it off, right? There's lots of methods in Western psychology that attempt to try to, in one way or another, get you to the end point, which is to not be feeling anxious. And in Morita therapy, the end point, in fact, is to accept your feeling of anxiety, right? Not to change it, but to accept it. Now, that may sound like it's not as optimum an endpoint as just getting rid of it altogether. But I'm going to suggest to you that it's a much more realistic endpoint, which is to accept that you're feeling anxious, because you really can't control it. And once you accept it, what you open up is the possibility that you can live your life coexisting with your unpleasant feeling. In this case, we're talking about anxiety as an example. You could live your life coexisting with anxiety, rather than every time you feel anxious, you have to kind of stop what you're doing and work on getting rid of your anxiety. And the story that I tell, which is a story that just occurred a few years ago, because I had been a living room musician for much of my life, And a few years ago, I decided that I was actually going to go out and play in public. The music that I play is mostly blues.
Oh, nice.
I'm a blues pianist. And I remember I used to go to these blues jams. Blues jams were where musicians would go, and then musicians would just get up on stage. They would be called up, so there would be like a rotation. It's very spontaneous. And you might be a harmonica player or guitar player, and you'd be called up, and you would just get together, and you would just start playing with whoever else was on stage. You'd finish the song, and then maybe one of the guitar players would get off stage, another one would come up. And I had decided that year was going to be the year that I got up on stage and played piano in front of an audience, right? And so I waited until the last blues jam of the year in December, because it was so terrifying. The idea of playing on stage in public at a club was so terrifying to me. And I remember the moment where I was at this blues jam, and I had signed up to go up and play, and the person who was running the jam said, Greg, can you come up here and play the keyboards for us, you know, the next couple of songs? And I remember just the huge adrenaline rush of fear and anxiety, and the tightening up of all my muscles, and just this incredible anxious response. And I also remembered that there was nothing I could control about my anxiety but to accept it. So while I was feeling that level of fear and anxiety, I was putting one foot in front of the other, walking towards the stage, getting up on the stage, and sitting down behind a piano. And within about 20 seconds, somebody said, oh, we're going to play this song in the key of A. And the next thing I knew, I was playing the piano on stage. But I had no confidence. I had an overwhelming sense of anxiety, but I was able to coexist with anxiety and do the thing that was important for me to do. And that's really what we teach people in this kind of psychology, is to be able to coexist with depression, with fear, with anxiety, with shyness, with loneliness, whatever challenging feeling that you're facing, and continue to live your life based on what's important for you to do, so that you don't basically give up your life when you're faced with a difficult or an uncomfortable feeling. And now we're in that situation with our anxiety over the pandemic, right? Over the virus, where we find ourselves in fear of our own health, family's health. We find ourselves anxious about our jobs. There's all kind of circumstances stimulating fear and anxiety. And so it's a wonderful time to practice this, right? To learn how to coexist with that, but then look at what's important for us to do. Again, it comes back to this issue of what can we control? We can't control our feelings. So what do? We accept them. But we can control how we conduct ourselves. So what do we do? You know, we go shopping for food. We put some of the food into a food bank box at the door for people who can't afford food. We Skype with our mother or our sister or something to see how they're doing. We do our work even though we're constantly feeling distracted. We wash the dishes. We clean the house. We do the things that are important for us to do, feeling anxious, feeling afraid. And there's a great empowerment that comes from that approach to life, as opposed to feeling that whenever we're faced with anxiety or fear, we're kind of at its mercy, right? So it's a very, very different approach to anxiety and fear. And I think it's an approach that really is a great fit for the challenges that we're facing in this pandemic.
I'm very familiar with feelings of anxiety, even relating to playing music live. I play guitar and...
Oh, great.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I felt anxious and sweaty hands. And when I played in Japan, I had to drink a few beers just to... I'm a very happy drunk. So if I became a happy drunk, I could then play. But once you take action, you take these baby steps, before you know it, you're doing and almost enjoying the thing you thought you could not do. And so this idea of acceptance is rooted in Buddhism, and I found it very powerful.
Can I just interrupt for one second? Because I just wanted to add, you know, Morita therapy, these principles in Morita therapy, many of them are derived from principles from Zen, from the what you might say would be the psychological principles we would find underlying Zen. But what's interesting, and I didn't really discover this till after I had been studying this for many years, but the approach that I recommend in terms of coping with feelings, this approach of acceptance, fits perfectly into the template of the Serenity Prayer that they use in AA in the 12-step program.
Okay.
And so if you look at that template of the Serenity Prayer, it's to accept what you can't control, right? And to have the courage to change what you can control, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so really what we're suggesting is to accept what you can't control, which in this case is your internal experience, your feelings, your thoughts, all these things that are uncontrollable, to change what you can control, which is your behavior, to put your energy into how you conduct yourself in the world and in relation to others, and the wisdom to know the difference, between what you can and can't control. So on the one hand, we have this approach to psychology that's really rooted in Eastern philosophy and Buddhism. And on the other hand, it really fits so nicely into a template of the Serenity Prayer from the 12-step program.
I see. I didn't know about the Serenity Prayer. So is that used in Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yes, it's the AA recovery program, right?
Okay. So I was about to quote something from your book, which sort of encapsulates what we've discussed. So notice the feeling, recognize it for what it is, take a deep breath, and then shift your energies to that which needs doing. And this is obviously the vital next step is you recognize what the feeling is, you take a deep breath, and then you take some sort of action. And it doesn't have to be a massive, big action. It can just be a baby step. And then I guess once you've done that step, you take the next step and the next step and keep going. So it's almost like the English phrase, keep calm and keep going. I'm not sure what it is. But so that leads to what I found really appealing in your book was the inaction demons, and what I used in the subject line to the email I sent you, because you know, I had uncertainty about contacting you and, you know, would you reply and will you come on my podcast? So I think I wrote my inaction demons didn't let me stop me from contacting you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to look at our fears and uncertainty in regard to inaction. We could see it as a demon. So do you want to touch on that?
Sure. I think that we have all kinds of ways, all kinds of strategies, some of which we've really become very skillful at, to keep us from doing the things that we need to do in our life, right? And so when I talk in my book about the demons of inaction, that's a list of those strategies. And we can think of that also as just the resistance that we have doing certain things. We gravitate towards doing things that are pleasurable. We gravitate towards doing things that are easy to do. Gravitate towards doing things that kind of have some clarity involved. But when we're faced with a situation where what we need to do stimulates feelings of discomfort or anxiety, or it's confusing, we're actually not sure how to do it, like, how do I fix my microwave? You know, so there's a sense of confusion or not knowing. We tend to avoid those things. And what happens often when we avoid things that are important for us to do is that we develop a skill that we don't want to have, which is a skill or a habit of essentially going with our feelings, right? If I don't feel like working on my taxes, I won't do it. You know, if I don't feel like doing the dishes in the sink, I won't do it. Mm-hmm. So we do the things we feel like doing, and we don't do the things we don't feel like doing. And for me, I think that that's the best definition of procrastination. Procrastination really is an issue of how we're dealing with our emotional or feeling state. And it's often that we're doing the things that only the things or primarily the things that make us feel good or we think will make us feel good, and we're avoiding the things that don't. But empowerment really is about being able to do the things that we don't feel like doing because they need to be done in our lives, right? And our lives often end up being better, more successful. We have less problems when we do things that need to be done when they need to be done. And that means that, again, we have to learn how to coexist with feelings like anxiety. If you do taxes, I assume that in Australia you have some kind of tax reporting system.
Yes.
But if people do that and they find that confusing and complicated, and therefore they try to avoid it and wait till the last minute. And I speak of this from experience because I was like this for many years. Then what you do is you just create more suffering for yourself. Mm. You know, if you think about it, the least amount of suffering is to just do your tax really early, get it filed, and be done with it, right? Otherwise, if you wait months and months until the last minute, you have all those months to worry about it and be anxious about it. So as we're facing things in our current situation, there's probably going to be a number of things that we're going to have to deal with, you know, we're going to feel like we don't want to do them. We're going to want to avoid them. They produce anxiety. They stimulate fear. And we have to be able to coexist with those feelings while we take whatever steps are necessary in terms of those kinds of issues. And if we do that, we'll manage our lives and we'll manage, in this case, our circumstances, coping with these circumstances, much more effectively than if we let our feelings paralyze us or if we're constantly looking for a way to transform them into feeling good, right? So there's an underlying assumption that, you know, feeling anxious, fearful, lonely, depressed is part of the human condition. There is no permanent escape from that. It's just part of the human condition. And rather than try to find some permanent cure for those kinds of feelings, we learn to basically live our lives in spite of those feelings. And by doing that, we get a lot more done in our life. It's not just that we're more productive, but we're also more responsible, and in many cases more successful. And in many cases, we cause less trouble and suffering to other people who are counting on us to do those things, right? When we say we're going to do them. So it's a great path, I think, for taking care of what we need to do in our life by, again, learning how to accept our feelings. We're not talking about denying our feelings, but learning how to accept them. And while we're accepting them, to move on. The metaphor that one of my students years ago developed was it's like going out for a drive in the car, and here you have this feeling of, let's say, fear. So you just pack up your fear in your backpack or your little suitcase, and you take it with you for a ride, right? And it sits in the back seat while you do the things you need to do, your errands and stuff while you're out. But for many people, anxiety and fear becomes the driver, right? We're talking about, we don't want our feeling state to be driving the car of our life. We want to be able to take that car where it's important to take it. But we also take those feelings with us because they're part of us. So they come along for the ride, but they don't prevent us from doing what we need to do while we're out.
You've actually reminded me of what Ken Moggi said to me in a podcast. And he said, Ikigai responds to proactiveness. And so if we have this inaction and this fear of doing things. And you describe the inaction demons as fear, indecision, discouragement, perfectionism, actually television, boredom, and difficulty. And so he says, Ikigai responds to us being proactive. So all you got to do is just get up. First thing in the morning, get up, brush your teeth. And then by doing all these small chores, if you approach them with this proactiveness, you're more likely to experience small tastes of Ikigai in your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that approach, and also this idea of, okay, yeah, if you're feeling fear, don't deny it because it's there. Don't make it drive you so you're constantly bouncing back to fear as something that's moving me forward and driving me, because that sounds very unhealthy. But yeah, accept it and say, okay, I've got this fear. Well, I'll just let it be with me, but I'm going to do something now. I'm going to do whatever it is I need to do. And I've found that over time, some of the things I found really difficult to do, they're still with me, but they don't pop up as often as they used to. And they're not as intense. The feelings are not as intense and paralyzing as they used to be.
Yeah, and that's a great description, Nick, I think, about what can happen over time. I've been playing on stage now for over 3 years, and but I still feel anxious in some cases when I get up on stage to play before an audience. So it's not like when you do that, the anxiety goes away. But the difference is that because I know that I can play anyway, whether I'm anxious or confident isn't that important anymore, right? When you think that you have to feel confident in order to, let's say, give a presentation or do something in front of others, if you think that it's necessary to have confidence, well, then you have to do everything you can to get confidence. But when you realize that if I feel relaxed and comfortable and confident, I can play music in front of people. And if I feel anxious and nervous, I can also play music in front of people, then it ceases to become such an important issue. And I think that that's really a great outcome. You know, in a sense, we're never really cured of anxiety, but we lose it loses its importance in terms of something that we are trying to get. You know, we just basically are willing to accept this is how things are. And suddenly the importance of it diminishes, and we're able to just move forward in our life.
So I think what we're talking about, Craig, is that we're working on ourselves. And I want to touch on something you mentioned in your course on the website, tricycle.org. And that's seeing the crooked tree as straight. And I'll let you go through this, but basically it's about how we try and solve our problems by fixing other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this metaphor or this example of seeing the crooked tree as straight. So would you like to explain that?
Yeah, well, I'll see if I can do the condensed version. It comes from actually a Zen story about a Zen monk named Ikkyu. And he was traveling through a province in Japan, and the governor of that province had put up a sign in front of this very gnarly, crooked kind of large tree that was growing. It's the kind of tree that, if you've ever seen trees that are on the coast by the water, you know, that have been really sculpted by the winds and the rains, you know, it was just an incredibly sculpted and crooked tree. And he put up a sign saying that anybody who can see this tree as straight will win a prize, right? And all these people would see the sign, and they would look at the tree, and they'd walk around it to try to look at it from a different angle. They would think there must be some place where you can stand, where you can see that this tree is straight. Some people would lay down under the tree. One person actually went home and brought a ladder back to try to climb up to the crown of the tree and look down on it. But when Ikkyu came by, he was a Zen monk. He looked at the tree, and in a moment, he left, and he went right to the governor's mansion, And he said, I'd like to see the governor because I have the answer to the riddle and I'm here for my prize. And the governor said, okay, well, governor was a little skeptical. And he said, well, tell me, how did you see the crooked tree is straight? And EQ looked at him and just said, it's crooked. And that's the answer to the riddle. So what does that actually mean? And I, in the piece that I wrote, I talked about what that means in terms of our human relationships with others. And seeing a person, when we see people, everybody looks crooked in the sense that everybody's got their faults. Everybody's got their problems and limitations. And there's all these people in our life and we see how they're living and we think, why don't they just get their act together, right? Why don't they just, do this or do that? We don't understand why they just can't get their act together and live a good life like I am, right? Like we are. So we see all these people as crooked and we put a lot of energy into trying to straighten them out. We do that by talking to them and telling them what they need to do. We counsel them uninvited. We send them emails about it. So we put a lot of our energy into trying to fix and straighten up other people who we see as crooked, right? And of course, they're doing the same thing with other people. And what we don't realize, what I don't realize, is that everybody who's in my little forest around me, they see me as crooked.
Yes.
Right? And so we're all trying to straighten each other out. But EQ's response of how you see the tree as straight is by just seeing that it's crooked is a way of basically just accepting the crookedness of the tree in the sense that there's nothing to be fixed. This is the nature of the tree. This is how it is. There's really nothing to fix about it, right? It's fine the way it is. And if we were able to do that, if we were able to stop trying to fix and rescue, because I say fix, but it's not just often we're trying to fix people in a way that we are trying to be compassionate, right? We love these people. We want them to have better lives. We want to rescue them from some of the suffering that they're going through, which we feel is unnecessary because they didn't make good decisions. But if we could just stop trying to fix people, stop trying to rescue them from their own nature, and we could accept them, it would create all of this now freed up space for us to just love them, right? And I had this experience with my own mother. She passed away about 5 years ago, but my mother spent a lot of time complaining about everything. And I remember being in the car with her once. She lived in Chicago and I was visiting her. We were driving back. She loved the horse races, you know, the thoroughbred racing at the racetrack. And so I had gone with her and we were driving back. And the whole ride back, it was just one complaint after another. And finally, I looked at her and I said, you know, Mom, you complain a lot. And she looked at me, she gave me this look out of her eye, I can't really put it into words, and she said, maybe I like complaining. And I had this little light bulb go off, this little epiphany, that her complaining wasn't a problem for her, it was my problem, right? And I didn't need to fix her complaining. It wasn't my job to get her to be a non-complaining human being. She was actually very comfortable being who she was. So she was a crooked tree. She was very comfortable with her crookedness. The problem was I needed to be able to be comfortable with her crookedness. And actually that little moment helped me do that. It helped me drop a lot of my efforts, not all of them, but a lot of my efforts to try to get her to change in the way that I thought would be good for her. And as a result, when I stopped trying to fix her, we actually had a much better relationship. It improved significantly in terms of my just being able to concentrate on what can I just do to be a loving son towards my mom. So that was a wonderful gift, that particular moment, but it was very much in line with what I think EQ was saying in this Zen story.
It's a powerful experience when that happens. That's happened with me to other family members where I had these expectations that I just thought were normal, that so-and-so should treat me this way and so-and-so should behave this way. And then the day you realize these have been my expectations and now that I've accepted who they are, everything is so much better. I'm not wasting all this mental energy on being upset or frustrated because they didn't meet my expectations. And yeah, our relationships improved and life is just better for everyone because I'm not, you know, complaining or revealing that, you know, hey, when I do this, you know, it's just normal for you to do this. And that's not the case. That's an expectation I used to have. So yeah, it's very powerful when you have that experience. And I think I was very fortunate that happened to me to realize I'm having these expectations of other people. When they don't meet them, I get upset. And so I'm causing my own pain. But as you say, if I see the crooked tree as straight, meaning I accept who they are, everything about life is just easier and you're setting them free and yourself free in a sense.
Yeah, and there's a great quote. I wish I could remember where this comes from, but the quote is that trying to change another person is an act of aggression. Accepting another person is an act of love.
Love, great. What a great quote.
Yeah, and I love that because whenever I'm trying to change another person, if I can remember that, I'm thinking like, this is an act of aggression, you know? But so I think it also dovetails right back into this issue of what's controllable and what isn't. And other people's behavior is not controllable by me. I can't control my wife's behavior. I have two daughters. I can't control their behavior. I can't control Donald Trump's behavior. You know, I can't control anybody's behavior except my own, right? Everybody else's is uncontrollable by me. So I do much better when I keep that in mind and really focus on how I want to conduct myself and live instead of looking at other people and trying to figure out what they need to do different.
There are so many questions I have and I'd love to discuss, but I think we've gone for 40 minutes. And I think we probably should end with focusing on what we can do or what advice you have for people struggling with this new lifestyle we're going through where we're isolated, where we can't go out and live the life we've experienced for how many years we've lived. So what's your advice to people who are struggling in this situation?
It's, you know, again, this is not an easy situation for any of us, and it's new territory for all of us, so we're all trying to figure out how to make this transition. And because we don't know what's going to happen, you know, tomorrow or next week or in the summer, we don't know what we're trying to transition to, right? So I think I had the realization just a couple of days ago that part of my experience now in the last couple of weeks staying at home is that I'm spending no time planning for the future. All of my mental energy is about today, right? What do I need to do today? I'm not planning vacations. I'm not planning travel. I'm not planning seminars, you know. And so I'm very grounded now, which is actually kind of easier. You know, it's easier to just focus on the day. And I like the idea of just taking life a day at a time. It makes a lot of sense to me. But the big thing that I would suggest to people, one of the strategies that I think can be most helpful is you can't control all of this news coming at you, you know, that here's what's going on in Italy and here's the number of deaths in Sydney. And you're just bombarded by all this news about what's happening globally with the pandemic. But what we have to do, I think, is come back to our immediate surroundings and our life and the present moment, not just today, but actually right now, and see throughout the day if we can find little moments of joy, little moments of being thankful for something, because that's the best opportunity we have, again, to try to keep ourselves sane and healthy under these circumstances. And so, you know, when I look at my day, it's kind of the end of our day today, but you know, I look at this walk I took in the morning with my daughter, and we found this bush called the pussy willow, which has these beautiful little white buds that are only come out for a few days in the spring. And we actually found one, and it had been raining, so there was little drops on them, and it was just very extraordinarily beautiful to just see that. And then because we live in the woods, you know, I have a bird feeder, and we have these birds. I don't know if they have them in Australia, called chickadees. Do you have chickadees in Australia?
I don't know. Probably not.
Anyway, we have these little small birds called chickadees, and I've gotten to know them over the years, and so they'll eat out of my hand. So I can go out with bird seed and just stand there, and many of them will just come and land right on my hand and take the seed. That's a high point of my day. Mm. I love that experience of connecting with another species. Having my first cup of coffee in the morning. I love good coffee, and taking that first sip and closing my eyes and just feeling that rich taste of coffee and feeling it go down my throat. So, you know, what we want to try to do is stay grounded in our real life, right? If you don't have the coronavirus and you're worried you're going to get it, the reality is right now you don't have it.
Have it, yeah.
As far as you know. So stick with the reality of what you know and what you can experience within your house, within your bedroom, you know, on your front porch, and see if you can find little moments of joy, of opportunities for thankfulness, of things that are interesting and beautiful. It's springtime. Now, you're in the opposite seasons, right?
Yeah.
So you're in fall, but we're just starting our spring here in the U.S. And so there's a lot of buds on the trees, and there's flowers kind of just starting to shoot up out of the ground. And there's lots to see in terms of this rebirth that occurs in spring. And so I find that for me, it's great to just walk around and find little signs of spring. And that's really our strategy for being able to continue to enjoy life within a situation that is extremely challenging to us. So if you're listening to this, I would really encourage you to try to make that your practice today or tomorrow, to just look for little opportunities where you can find something that makes you smile, or that's interesting or beautiful, or gives you a little moment of joy. When my daughters were little, when they were children, and I would put them to bed, I would always ask, the last thing I would ask them was, tell me what the highlight of your day was. They would share something with me, and sometimes they'd ask me and I'd share something. I always did that because I wanted that to be the last thing that they focused on before they closed their eyes and went to sleep. But I find it actually works really well for me too, to just think about, you know, sometimes I'll be in bed with my wife, and I'll just say, what was the highlight of your day, Linda? You know, and she'll say the same thing to me. And it's a really nice note to kind of end the day, but it also reminds you that you have to look for and sometimes make those highlights happen throughout the day.
Now, you've reminded me of one of Ken Moggi's pillars of Ikigai, which is the joy of little things.
Yes.
And also, another one is also being in the here and now. And you can't really enjoy the little things without being in the here and now. Mm-hmm. And it is such a simple thing to do. And as you mentioned, you know, I was thinking about the beautiful smell of coffee this morning. And we've had extremely beautiful weather the last couple of weeks. And now I go for walks, and there's no traffic, and you sort of have this awareness of things are quieter. And I'm fortunate to have a lovely walking track near my house, and yeah, you just feel more present, and you can embrace all these little things that we just take for granted every day. So I think that's really good advice, to ground ourselves and to embrace and appreciate the small things that really make up the meaning of our lives. So, Greg, where can people find you? Is it TODO, which a lot of people misinterpret as todoinstitute.org.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually the best website
to find my writing and the content of what we're offering as an organization is a site called 30,000days.org. And it's just all one word, 30,000 days, all letters. That's actually also the name of our journal, because 30,000 days is the average number of days that we have to live in our life, right? So we decided to name our website 30,000days.org. So that's a great place to find all of our resources. And if people want to contact me directly, they're welcome to email me at Greg, G-R-E-G-G, at todoinstitute.org. So it's T-O-D-O, the word institute.org. But for all of your listeners, I really wish you well, and I hope you stay healthy and safe. And I hope that you do what you can to try to use your time in whatever way that seems meaningful for you, even during periods that we have like of isolation right now. Because I'm doing a series right now of features over the next 3 weeks, and the name of the series is called Life Not on Hold. And you know, we may be quarantined or isolated. We may be facing a situation in which we really can't be out and about, but our life is still going. It's the clock is still ticking, and we have to figure out how to use this time as valuably as we can. So anyway, good luck to everybody. And Nick, it was such a pleasure having this conversation with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Likewise, Greg. Thank you for coming onto the podcast, and I'll definitely want to ask you back, and I will link to all your websites in the podcast notes. So thank you very much, Greg.
This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.